Here we are at the second Wednesday of the month. It's time for the Dirt Bag. Good morning and welcome. This is Glenn Andreessen, and here beside you now until 12 o'clock. With me in the studio today is Matthew Shepard from the Xerces Society. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
Apparently, Matthew is returning with my limited mental state. I didn't remember that he'd been on some years ago.
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Yeah, well, thank you. And also with me is Jim Gilbert of One Green World.
Morning, Glenn.
Full disclosure, One Green World is an underwriter of this program. Jim's only going to be with us for a half an hour today because Jim is going to be getting an award from the governor and the Secretary of State, too.
The Secretary of State and the governor will be shaking their hands soon.
And this is a sustainability award for your biz.
Governor's Sustainability Award for Small Business. We're extremely proud to get this award.
You said that you had hired a sustainability person even three, four, five years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, and that really helped us focus on you know, our efforts in different areas, and we got some government grants and to help us build some things that we probably wouldn't have done otherwise. We've done a lot of interesting things for a little farm out there in the country. We've got solar panels on our shipping building. We built a rainwater harvesting tank, almost an acre foot of rainwater we can harvest. Jeez. And use.
Oh, you probably got plenty now.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's, it keeps coming, too, you know. Our tank overfloweth. And we're just finishing up a project of us installing bottom heat in our greenhouses, which will save somewhere about 30% of our propane that we use right now to heat greenhouses with. And then there's also some things we've been doing for many, many years, which I when I first started farming, my philosophy was that I wanted to return the earth, to have the earth in better shape when I got done with it than when I started. And so drip irrigation has been a part of our program for a long time, save water and put the water where the roots are, not just all over the fields.
Yeah.
And mulching with sawdust in our nursery rows to conserve water and keep weeds down, and using cover crops to keep weeds from growing. And so we're, we're really honored to get this award. It's great.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, one of those practices may be hedgerows, and that will be the part of, I'm hoping, one of the subjects that Matthew will talk about in the latter half of the show on the brand new book from the Xerces Society, Attracting Native Pollinators. We're not going to be talking about honeybees today, but there's all sorts of other bees out there, and we'll get a line on that. That we'll talk, first of all, about the plant of the month, which will be figs. Jim knows a thing or two about figs, and then we'll also be talking about, what's going on in the vegetable garden. And yeah, I'm about ready to put out my irrigation system.
Yeah, I know. Drought is not around the corner.
That's right. But figs! And take it away.
Okay. Well, first we might want to mention the things that are going on.
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah,
of course.
We're sort of getting on the slower side of the garden show world, which I have to admit I'm somewhat relieved. It's been a long spring, and living in Seattle and living in Eugene to do a couple shows in those places, that's something I didn't really anticipate doing this year, but I did. But it's coming up. There's some Earth Day celebrations. There's sort of garden shows. Probably the most interesting one is the one at the Oregon Garden in Silverton this Saturday, because you can go there and see all sorts of vendors and booths of different organizations, and then you can walk around in the garden itself. And admission is free on Earth Day.
Oh.
So
on Earth Day or this celebration day?
The celebration day, which is this Saturday on the 16th. Also, the Leech Botanical Garden has a garden sale on Saturday at the Floyd Light Middle School, which is at 108th in Southeast Washington.
Probably a lot of native plants.
Native plants
there as well as specialty nurseries.
Yep. I think there's over 15 specialty nurseries that'll be there. There'll be some fruiting plants as well. And then the following weekend, the Japanese Garden's having its plant sale, which is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There are a lot of really interesting plants, plus some Asian-themed plant material.
Yeah, we ought to, maybe we'll work in Asian pears into one of our plant of the month.
We could do that.
Yeah. Sometime there.
We could bring some to eat, too. Hopefully we'll have some this year.
Yeah. They're starting to bloom.
Yeah. If the darn weather will give the bees a chance to fly around. And then there's a great event here in Portland, which is the sort of city repair celebration at the old Washington High School on 12th and Stark. That's also on Saturday, April 23rd. There's a lot of interesting booths, a lot of music, a lot of fun. We were there last year and just had a great time.
Great.
Yeah. And then the last one that I had on my note on my list was this is really a scene for people, really hardcore plant folks, is the Canby, the Clackamas County Master Gardeners plant sale in Canby Clackamas County Fairgrounds. That is incredible. I think it's got to be the biggest plant sale in the Northwest, if certainly one of them.
Yeah.
Hundreds of vendors. People bring wheelbarrows, carts, everything, and just walk up and down the aisles and fill them with plants. And that's on April 30th and May 1st, Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, that's good timing.
And
one other event that I'll pass along is the return of the movie Queen of the Sun on the Honeybees to the Hollywood Theater, opening on Earth Day, and it will also open nationwide on that day, or around that day, I believe,
I wanted to see that film.
That's back
great.
That's at the Hollywood Theater, and I'm hoping to, during our next show in May, have the director back for a small segment to talk about that, Taggart Siegel, the director of the movie, so we'll look forward to that.
Great. I'm glad there's another chance to see the film.
That's right.
To see it.
So, okay, so now we're on to figs.
Okay, well.
Excuse me, before we do that, and if you send me that list, Jim, I will post it at the KBOO website.
Absolutely. Yeah, okay. I can do that. Well, figs, one thing I know about figs is how to eat them. And I love figs. I live for fig season. In fact, it's like there's hardly a fruit that's better. I mean, I can't describe just how wonderful and delicious those fruits are. Delectable, sweet. Just tender. Oh.
Okay.
And so if you haven't eaten a fresh fig, it's really something you should not deny yourselves that opportunity in life.
Yeah.
Life is short without a fresh fig.
And the life of figs is short.
The life of figs is short. That's right. And one of the things about figs is that they don't transport well when they're fully ripe. So growing them at home in your neighbor's yard or your neighbor farmer, that's where to get your figs, because when they're shipped from California, they're just not the same. They to get them in a truck and handle them for hundreds of miles, they've got to pick them before they're fully ripe.
Mm-hmm.
So you're just not going to get the
flavor. And they don't ripen off the tree.
They don't ripen off the tree. Yeah. So growing figs has been done in Oregon for a good 100 years now. I was actually fortunate to meet a man who had a catalog from a fig nursery that existed in the 1920s. I did a little history, found out some history of that. And figs are very variety specific. There are hundreds of varieties in the world, but very, very few of them will ripen in our climate.
Uh-huh.
So that's really important to get the right variety. And one man brought over 100 varieties to Oregon and tried them out to see which ones would work, and I think 5 out of the 100 were ones that would ripen here reliably. So it is important to do that. And a lot of people don't know, figs can bear 2 crops, one on the old wood in the summer and then the second on the new wood in the fall. And of those ones that bear in the summer, there are very few that really do a good crop here, except for one. And it's got a sort of a funny name for a fig for Oregon, but it's Desert King.
Uh-huh.
And if I were going to plant a fig anywhere in west of the Cascade Mountains, which is where they really need to be, they don't stand temperatures below zero, Desert King is one of the ones I would plant, because it's a very, very high-quality fig, as well as doing well in that summer crop. When the weather's warm, you can go out and pretend you're on the Mediterranean, walk through your fig orchard, pick
clothing
figs.
Optional.
Oh man, yeah, really. And then the fall figs are the ones that really test our weather. And so varieties like Latarula, Vern's Brown Turkey, in Portland Peter's Honey Fig in a nice warm spot does well. Those ones will ripen good crops on that.
And what time of year are those ripening?
Mid to late September.
Okay.
Depending upon
and the Desert King.
Desert King is July, late July.
What about planting of these figs? What's anything
They're very easy to grow, really. Normal soil, they don't require acid soil. Just normal garden soil, clay soil is fine.
In fact, something that I remember from years ago when I planted my first Desert King that I don't know if this is correct or not, that figs actually like their roots to be constricted a little bit. Have you heard anything like that?
I've not experienced that. I mean, okay. You can certainly grow them in a pot, and a lot of people talk about growing figs in containers, and they yeah. will get their roots restricted by that process, yeah. but I haven't had any issue okay. with that. We actually get pretty good crops from ours, and they're just growing out in the open. So,
and I didn't mean necessarily in a pot, but just clay soil would work fine then, because they've got their roots constricted.
yeah, that's true. So clay is great, and they like sun. Half-day sun is okay, but I wouldn't try to – they will not – they'll grow in a shadier environment, but they won't bear fruit.
Right.
Which
okay.
is sort of interesting too. They're self-fertile. No pollination is required.
What about fertilizer, water?
Just a good application of compost in the spring yeah. will keep them growing happily. They don't.
They grow a lot without any fertilizer, really.
That's right. Watering, a deep watering once a week during the hot spell was also, they like that. They can stand some drought, but yeah. If you want to get good fruit,
and then
to water them.
Pruning.
Yeah, and I like to prune them to a vase shape. Spread them out, get a lot of air around the fruit, mm-hmm. keep everything happy that way. But they can grow tall depending upon the variety. Desert King is yeah. probably one of the most vigorous ones, so it can go up, and I try to thwart that desire by pruning back the top and forcing out side branches.
And where is the fruit going to be?
Well, in the Desert King, like I said, it bears on last year's wood. So
okay.
if you prune off all of last year's wood, you'll be unhappy. You won't get any fruit.
But if you don't prune off any, the new wood will continue to be at the ends, and that's where the fruit will be then.
Right, and so with Desert King, it's sort of a balancing act where once it gets to be of a decent size, mature size, and bearing decent crops, then you start taking off some of the old wood and leaving some of the old wood. So you'll
yeah.
get a crop, but you'll start reducing it from keeping it from getting so tall.
That's right.
And it's interesting. Fig is kind of an interesting fruit botanically, too. When I give talks on fruit growing, I ask people, have you ever seen a fig flower? And of course, some people haven't even seen a fig. But if they have seen a fig, then I ask them if they've seen a flower. And most, it's interesting because they haven't. And the reason is...
We've had this as a garden stumper, I believe, didn't we?
We might have had that. That's
yeah.
right.
Because the flower's inside
the fig.
Yeah,
that's right. And it's interesting. Speaking of bees, because there are some figs that do require pollination, and those they use a wild wasp. It's actually a wasp that lives in the wild fig, and it crawls in the end of the cultivated fig, and spreads pollen about,
uh-huh.
and then flies back out again.
But that's not in these United States.
Well, it's in California.
Oh, there is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The Kalmerna fig is an example of that, of a fig that needs pollination.
Are there wild figs in California where these wasps would live?
They grow them specially for that purpose.
Ah. One step ahead of me, Jimbo.
Yep. And they'll take the branch from that wild fig and take the branch itself. The people know more about this than I do, the people that grow these figs, and apparently they know that inside those wild figs there are wasps, and they put that branch in the tree. And then these figs fly. The wasps fly out.
All right, that's Mr. Know-It-All, Jim Gilbert here on the Dirtbag on KBOO. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be right back. Thank you. That's Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, and I guess that really is the appropriate title, and that's kind of why I chose it, thinking of the figs and how they get mated and whatnot, or they don't get mated. It's all kind of enclosed. Well, that's called Sex in a Pan. Uh-huh. Sex in a Pan there. Okay, so a little bit more on figs here, on eating them.
Right, so now we've got our fig tree planted, and it's growing well. And one nice thing is they bear fruit right away, so usually you plant this year, you'll have fruit next year.
It's pretty. And we can plant now.
You could plant now, yep.
And do they come bare root, or are they generally mostly potted?
Both ways, but I think potted right is probably more common.
Okay.
And remember, the thing about planting a potted plant is to loosen up the roots so that they don't, when you put it in the soil. And then the fun part, of course, comes when the fig is ripe. And people do ask me about, well, how do I know when to pick that fig? It's kind of shaped a little bit like a light bulb, and it sticks out pretty straight out from the branch when it's unripe, and as it starts to ripen, it'll start to droop. And the softer and more drooping it gets, the sweeter it gets.
Mm-hmm. And more tempting for the birds.
Yes, and the birds will eventually go for it, but possibly even some ants might crawl up the trunk for it too, but... But I don't have that problem so much with either of those creatures. So I just go out there, and as they start to get nice and soft and they're drooping, you can actually clip them off with a pair of pruners, or you can sort of just tear it off at the base.
Just lift up, cradle it, lift it up, and it should separate there.
Yeah. And then I love them fresh, of course, or put them in the refrigerator overnight and chill them. That's really a super treat for breakfast.
Yeah,
invite your neighbors over. I mean, you will just knock your socks off. And then some people like to. I just eat the whole fig, skin and all. Some people like to sort of peel it back a little bit, just eat the sort of inner part.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's. I eat it all.
Yeah. Well, sometimes not the stem part.
Yeah, the stem is a little hard. You know, to eat that unless you're really a purist. But.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
That's our plant of the month. Next month will be actually it's pledge drive. And we will be having some thank you gifts, some trees, columnar apples probably, and some other things. Our plant of the month next month will be tomatoes. Hopefully we'll get to some weather where it's suitable.
I just remember I had a dream last night about ripe tomatoes, or like green tomatoes. They were in. I dreamed about this. Seriously, I just remember that. Wow.
You're a month too early on your dreaming there, I guess.
It's the weather.
Sure. Well, speaking of weather, this is getting to me. It's making me a little cranky. And the vegetables are, well, the cold season crops are really loving it. Some lettuces, the greens, the peas, if they can survive the onslaught of the slugs, this is great for them. They're going to do it. I remember last year, I wrote an article for the column that I do in the Portland Alliance. I wrote about how we can plant our garden like you might diversify your financial portfolio in that, well, you plant some of everything. So if you have cooler weather, those things will thrive and you're not completely shut out of that. So keep that in mind when we start planting. I was at a nursery a couple weeks ago. It was just a week and a half ago. And gosh, they had tomatoes for sale already. Can you believe that? A little early to be putting them out. In fact, I've got some home improvement project going on at home and don't have a greenhouse anymore
at the moment.
And my tomatoes were out during that 30 1 degree temperature we had, and they took a hit.
We were down to 27. My Russian friends, it's very common when you're traveling around that part of the world to see they make little greenhouses out of plastic because their climate's worse than ours, believe it or not. And so they just make a small 4 foot tall, 5 foot tall greenhouse with some bamboo stakes or whatever they use, and just cover them up. And you'll get about 5 degrees of frost protection with that. So it would have to get down to 27 for any damage to occur.
Yeah. Well, I think the tomatoes are going to survive. They were just little seedlings that I had not transplanted yet, but I have since done so. And now I bring them into the house when looks like it's going to be below 40 because tomatoes are really too cold. But there's other things that we can get out into the garden now, including many, if not all, of the brassicas, broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, kohlrabi. Some of those can be direct seeded. Some can be bought in seedlings and then transplanted out. Still way too early for any of the warm season crops, meaning corn. Yeah. Or
the soil is cold.
Yeah. And so it would be a hard time even maybe germinating. Well, typically you'd be able to put out beets and Swiss chard carrots now, but I haven't seeded them yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been pretty busy too, but it's pretty chancy with this weather. So
I wonder if you planted them and then put some a piece of plastic over the top to sort of collect some heat that way.
And sometimes I put panes of glass over the top of my beds to help them germinate, which is what I've done with the peas, which are doing fine, but boy, they've been nibbed by the little tiny slugs, baby slugs. Mm. So I just need to get out there at night or in dusk or even during the day when it's rainy, and do that.
Yeah, this is good slug weather.
Well, normally, according to my chart here and my outdoor seed starting, I would have, let's see here, in April, chard, lettuce, parsley, potatoes. Oh, yeah, time to do potatoes or pastime or good time to do potatoes. That spinach could also be broadcast seeded. That's very nice to do, very easy to do when we've got a slew of rainy weather coming on. You don't really have to worry about putting too much dirt over the top of them ever. And when I say broadcast, I mean literally we just really don't even make any rows, furrows, or anything like that. Just take some of the seed in your hand and sprinkle them around on the soil surface and maybe rake it in a little bit. Or what I tend to do is just cover it with a quarter of an inch of compost, something like that. Very easy to do. You get pretty good coverage that way and don't have to worry about thinning too much.
Yeah.
And it's the same technique that I use with carrots, too.
It seems like the compost covering would be especially good this year because that ground is wet. You know, the soil is wet.
Yeah.
It's hard to even loosen it up.
Indeed. So that works very well. Now, I've started a lot of seeds inside, and in fact, well, it's getting on too late for starting tomatoes, but probably not. I mean, who knows what kind of a year we're going to have. One cautionary event would be if we have a cold summer, similar to last year's, and who knows, it might be a good idea to try some of the smaller tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Certainly cherry tomatoes will ripen, but if you're going for the beefsteaks, we may not have the hot weather long enough in order to get those ripened. So, and maybe try some of the OSU bred tomatoes, Glacier, Willamette, Oregon Spring. But realize that I'm not a big fan of the flavor of those. But any homegrown tomato is better than a store-bought one. So once again, this is kind of hedging your bets by planting more than one variety, and you're liable to get some.
That's a good idea.
Okay, that's probably about enough time for that. We want to make sure Matthew has time to talk about the book and handle your questions. If you have any gardening questions, don't hesitate to call us. 503-231-8187. And that's also the number that you will call to answer the garden stumper. That's coming up next. Okay, as Jim makes his exit here, give our best to the Gov.
Absolutely, thank you.
Today's question is, and Jim has no idea what this is, and neither does Matthew, but the garden stumper for today is, what was the first food eaten in space by an American astronaut? What was the first food eaten in space by an American astronaut? And I'll give you a hint, it's not Tang. It's not Tang. Is that even food? All right, if you know the answer to that, give us a call, 503-231-8187. Meanwhile, to introduce Matthew Shepard, we'll go to our next tune, and you'll have to turn this up. It's a real pretty low recording there, so go ahead and run that now, Kurt, please.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
What should you want to know? Don't you mind about the future? Don't you try to think ahead. Save tomorrow for tomorrow. Think about today instead. Oh, yeah. Oh, I could give you facts and figures. Yeah, I could give you plans and plans. Even tell you where I'm going. Yeah. To know why you obsessed with fighting.
What's the buzz? What's the buzz? That's called Buzz, Buzz, Buzz. That's from Jesus Christ Superstar, believe that or not. That's kind of a funky tune. You know, I played that musical one time in the orchestra pit, and it was a great gig because it's just one act. 90 minutes, done. So, but anyway, I thought that would work to bring Matthew into the conversation, the Buzz, Buzz, Buzz here, and talk about the new book.
Great. Thank you.
This is not the first book that the Xerces Society has released.
That's right.
But before we talk about this, we should just bring us up to date on what the Xerces Society is.
Sure. The Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation, we're a nonprofit based here in Portland, but we work nationwide and in other countries. Our focus is on the conservation of insects and other invertebrates, with the basic mission of trying to protect them and conserve their habitats.
And I think you should explain the name. Sure. It always confuses a lot of people, and how it's spelled, for one.
Yeah, we have occasional debates of whether we need to change the name or not.
Well, I kind of like it.
Well, we like it too, and it's got a history now because we're celebrating our 40th anniversary this
Goodness
year.
Goodness gracious.
So, you know, people know the Xerces Society, and people may not be able to spell it nor pronounce it, but once they know it, they don't forget it.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to do a search on my saved addresses. I just say X, and there's not many X's that come up. So,
yeah, the Xerces blue butterfly is, or was, one of the first insects known to go extinct in North America because of human activity. Used to live on the San Francisco Peninsula area and was last seen flying in 1943 when the American military during the Second World War built a new munitions dump. And that was the end of it. And so when Robert Michael Pyle decided 40 years ago that at a time when there were all these other conservation organizations coming forward to protect the panda and other bears and eagles and so on, that someone should speak out and do some work to protect the small things. And so he had this idea of a conservation organization and named it after a butterfly that was known to have already gone extinct.
Spelled?
X-E-R-C-E-S.
Xerces.
Yes.
Okay. That's it. So I attended the book release party. I guess it was a party.
We wanted it to be a party.
And it felt that way, too. And was very impressed with Robert Michael Pyle, as mm-hmm. well as all the other members. I don't know if he's the, you know, emeritus past everything.
He's the founder.
The founder of it.
He purposely didn't get involved with running it because, as he said, he'd seen too many people with founder's disease, as he calls it.
He's a character.
He is. Too. He's a great guy.
And your position there is?
I spent I'm actually been there for 11 years now, which startles me when I look back at it. And I've spent, since that, I arrived in 1999, I started working on pollinator conservation back in the early days when no one really knew what it was. And it was a really small scale thing. And we've built it up. And since then, and so now we're one of the major players in the country addressing the conservation of pollinator insects. Mm-hmm. And our major focus has been native bees for the entire time, because they're just profoundly important. If there's one group of pollinating insects you want to work on, it's bees. And we know about the honeybee and the importance of the honeybee for agriculture in particular. But the honeybee is not actually native to this country. And so we've chosen, as a conservation organization focused on biodiversity, to focus our efforts on native bees. It doesn't mean that we're like anti-honeybee or that. It's just that, I mean, when there's so many other people trying to promote protection and, you know, health of honeybees, et cetera, one more organization isn't going to make a lot of difference.
The honeybees have their own lobbyists.
Yeah, and also a lot of things that you can do for native bees will help honeybees, simply because when you're working to increase the diversity of flowering plants for bees, then honeybees benefit. When you're working to reduce pesticides, then, you know, honeybees benefit too. So,
this new book here, Attracting Native Pollinators, mm-hmm. is that written for, who's that written for?
We've tried to cover a wide range of people. So if you're a backyard gardener, you'll find something in there. If you're a grower, whether it's a small-scale grower or a large-scale grower, you'll find something in there. So, I mean, essentially, if you've got a patch, and it can be a small patch or a big patch, but if you've got a patch that you think has pollinators or could be improved for pollinators, you'll find something in the book. The book basically is the recipe. And so you can open it up and you'll find information on who the pollinators are, because although our main focus is bees, we do cover in the book butterflies and moths and flies and beetles as well, because if you look at the big picture, there are tens of thousands of insects that are pollinators, and bees are considered to be the most important single group, but there are also flies, and beetles, and obviously butterflies and moths that contribute to the pollination of flowers.
We focus here on the dirt bag mostly on edibles.
Mm-hmm.
What would be some beginning steps for a vegetable gardener to attract these pollinators in, because they would benefit? Their plants would, their vegetable plants and fruits would definitely benefit.
If you're actually growing the crops, the vegetable plants, then you're going to have a source of flowers that will attract bees. But you can do things that will support the bees away from your crops. You can put in a wider range of flowers, for example, in your garden, so that there are a continuous bloom, so that there's always food available from about now, frankly. The earliest of our bumblebees appeared in mid to late February.
I'd like to touch on bumblebees a little bit later, but continue this thought here.
Yeah, so, I mean, from when the bumblebees start to emerge, they're looking for food as well, all the way through to the fall, when the late bees begin to disappear and the bumblebees go back into hibernation. So you can put plants in. I mean, they can be native plants, things like Oregon grape, and later in the year, the penstemons and asters as well, all sorts of good native plants. But if you're a gardener and you're looking for culinary herbs, rosemary, oregano, basil. I'm showing my roots there.
Either way.
I mean, all of these can be good plants to support bees, as well as provide you with something that you can use from your land.
And just to further cast our net here, as far as the insects that we'd be attracting by planting those things, mm-hmm. we would also be attracting some of the beneficial insects, the parasitic wasps and other things that would help not with necessarily pollination, but with actual pest control.
Yeah, I mean, I've already mentioned flies as one mm-hmm. of the groups of pollinators. The syrphid flies, something called flower flies, because they're so closely associated with flowers. Because if you've got flowers, you're almost certainly going to find that you've got these flies.
And these are the flies that sometimes referred to as hoverflies.
Yeah.
That they dart, but they can hover in the air like a helicopter,
yeah,
if you will.
You can watch them, and sometimes you'll find that they're watching you because they'll turn around and keep their eye on you.
Yeah, but they're a fly.
Yeah,
even
they
look like a yellow jacket.
Some
species do.
They've got stripes and they look mean, but
they're a fly, so no stinger.
Nope. But I mean, as adults, they're drinking nectar, so they're moving, going from flower to flower, moving pollen around, and their larvae are these little kind of grub-like creatures that are fantastic predators of aphids. So if you've got an aphid problem, if you look, there's a good chance that you'll see their little larvae come just working around the aphid colony, eating them one by one.
So this first take-home message is, you know, if you plant for one thing, you're going to attract everything else, and that's good because everything is related.
Yeah.
And they'll help. They can keep your pests under control, really, even aphids. I kind of rejoice when I see my plums leaves just coated with aphids in some respects, because I know it's just a matter of time before the beneficial insects. But I'm planting things around there to attract the adults.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the other thing about choosing your plants is if you have a diversity of plants, you're going to have that diversity of insects, whether they're wasps to help control your pest problems or, you know, all the flies, et cetera, et cetera. And there's some really interesting research that's been coming out from a group based in University of Delaware, and they've been looking at the relationship between native plants and native insects. And it's phenomenal when you compare the diversity and abundance of native insects on native plants compared to non-native plants. And it's an order of like 4 times the diversity and 12 times the abundance. And it's really quite staggering, the benefit that you get from having native plants.
Speaking of benefits or lack of benefits, do you care to say anything about buddleia or the butterfly bush?
We care not to talk too much about buddleia.
Well,
no, I mean, it's funny. When I first moved here a dozen years ago, people were planting buddleia, and I looked at it, and I was aghast, because in Britain, buddleia is a recognized invasive plant, and I'd spent years cutting it down and clearing it away so that we can begin to restore the native grasslands. And so then subsequently, a few years later, when buddleia, particularly buddleia davidii, the purple flowering one, was added to the lists of plants that shouldn't be planted.
Yeah, we're just many years behind.
Yeah, but there's other great plants for butterflies as well. So it's not like you're not going to get butterflies.
Right, and from what I understand, that doesn't do anything to support the. It's not a host plant for the larvae.
No, it looks great because you get the adults on it, but if you want the adults, you need to have the caterpillars, which means conversely, you need to be planting plants in your garden that are going to get eaten.
Right.
And not by you.
But what is the role of butterflies as far as pollination goes?
They certainly help. One thing about butterflies is that they move fairly long distances. And so if they're carrying pollen, it's going more than just from one flower to another. I mean, I sit in my garden in the summer and I watch the swallowtails come through. And they land, and they might move around a bit, but then they're gone, and I don't see where they land. They're very strong flowers, so if they are going back, any pollen, that they've moved a long distance, and I'm hoping that they're going back to the same plant, the same species, otherwise... they help, and probably their main benefit is longer distance transfer of pollen. Bees and some of the flies, but bees in particular, because they have a nest, they're always working the area around the nest. And bees are also distinctive because they're one of the very few insects that actually actively collects pollen and transfers it and carries it around to get it back to its nest. And so it's rummaging. A bee is rummaging around in the flower all the time and looking for that pollen. And they also, once they've worked out how to manipulate one type of flower, they will go back to the same type of flower. So you can watch them. They go from one aster to the next aster to the next one to the next one. And so they have this really efficient, effective pollen movement, and the flowers benefit as well as the bees.
I'm speaking with Matthew Shepherd with the Xerces Society and the release of their new book on their 40th anniversary this year, apparently attracting native pollinators. And there's probably lots of lists of plants to attract these.
There are. The book is, I mean, it's 380 pages
and
more, and it's chock full of color photos, And we wanted it to be really practical. So it's no good saying, you know, oh, well, if you got this, do this. But if you're going to do that, how are you going to do it? So this book has got details on making nests and plant lists and, you know, management guidelines and all sorts of stuff.
Real how-to.
Yes.
Well, the next topic that we'll cover is bumblebees. Mm-hmm. I get a lot of calls on those as a honeybee keeper, and there's quite a bit of confusion there. On the Dirtbag on KBOO. Superheroes, that's what these pollinators are. They've evolved with plants over how many, 3-5 million years or something like that?
Longer than that.
Longer than that, okay.
100 million years.
Okay, 100 million years ahead. And they are intricately entwined, and we need them.
Yes.
I mean, we need them more than they need us.
Something like 70, 75, 80% of flowering plants relies upon an animal to pollinate it, and the majority of those animals are insects.
Well, next, let's talk about two species of bees. No, let me repeat the garden stumper, see if we can get anybody that wants to hazard a guess on this one. What was the first food eaten in space by an American astronaut? Yeah, it's not a ham sandwich. It's not Twinkies. That was Matthew's guess. And it's not Tang. We know that one, too. So 231-8187 if you know the answer to that, or if you have questions for Matthew. First, bumblebees. Mm-hmm. There are more than one species in this. There is more than one species in this area. Mm-hmm. Let's clear up some of that confusion.
Well, there's about 45 species nationwide, and we have 15 or 16 in the Willamette Valley. In my garden, I know I see four species typically over a year. They begin appearing in mid to late February, and I get one that unfortunately doesn't have a common name.
Oh.
Bombus rufus inctus.
Okay.
Which is a gorgeous bee. It's got that lovely orange back to it.
Oh,
and it's very distinctive, and people don't think it's a bumblebee because it's the wrong color, because I think bumblebees are black and yellow after all.
Can you repeat that? Rufus inctus?
Rufus inctus.
Rufus inctus.
Yeah, we sometimes call it the orange-backed bumblebee, but it doesn't have an official common name.
Okay, and these are ones that you will oftentimes see.
Yeah, they're one of the earliest ones to appear. They appear in mid-February.
And where do they nest?
Typically, they'll look for an existing hole in the ground, often an old rodent hole. They also go in under clumps of grass. They'll nest in your compost bin as well.
Uh-huh. If they I've get a removed chance. Many.
Yeah, and this one in particular is one of the bumblebees that nests frequently more above ground. So they do go into bird nesting houses too.
Uh-huh.
Which is often when people start noticing them later in the year.
And they seem to be, from my amateurish observations, they seem to be a little bit more defensive than some of the other bumblebees.
They can be, but if you're likely to nest in an area which is likely to be disturbed, then you're going to come out and defend your nest.
Yes.
as anybody would.
Indeed.
You know, but even so, I mean, if you're not disturbing them, they're not going to be chasing you.
Yeah, I've had people that are out gardening and they knock the post that the birdhouse is on, and then.
And they feel,
the
they're feeling grumpy at that point.
That's right. Okay, so that's one, this orange back.
Yeah,
one.
And the other one that comes out around the same time is the one that it's mostly black with a little bit of yellow on its tail and yellow on its shoulders and on its face. And the yellow hair on its face is white. It's called the yellow-faced bumblebee.
And what's the size relative
to
it?
A big queen can be maybe an inch long.
Okay, so those are longer ones that maybe.
Yeah.
That people typically
might... They're a good size.
Okay.
Yeah. So they come out, and the queens have hibernated, and they then look for a new nest to establish a new colony, and then they start producing their own offspring, and they have three or four generations through the year.
And these different species start earlier, and then they end earlier?
Well, the orange-backed... does end fairly early.
Like Rufus inctus?
Rufus inctus, yes.
Rufus inctus, okay.
Let's call it the orange back.
Okay.
Just to make it simple. And that colony cycle typically comes to end in June or July, which is when people start noticing them, whereas the other one will continue. And the yellow-faced, you'll see the next generation of queens out in October or November, even on a warm day.
People will, oftentimes when I counsel people, and that's oftentimes what I do on the phone. Mm-hmm. I'll say, well, if they're not bothering you, they will die out.
Yeah.
And so that gives me an idea of when to say now on some of those things.
Yeah.
So speaking of say now, we've got some... Oh, Garden Stumper answer here. Okay, Nancy, you're up. What's the food?
I think it's tapioca.
Oh, that's a good, excellent guess, but we don't grow tapioca in the garden.
Oh, gosh, it's something that you grow. That's the part I missed. Well, if
that's an excellent
tapioca, I don't know if I would.
That's an excellent guess, though.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Okay, Rodney, do you have a guess?
I would venture to guess that is a perfect food called honey.
That's another good guess, but it's also wrong. Then that reminds me that
it was a subject matter that we were speaking so fondly of.
Yeah, no, that's a good one though. But no, two excellent guesses, but no, I'm sorry, that's not right.
Well, good luck.
Okay, thanks a lot for calling, Felix. Do you have the answer here? First food eaten in space.
First food in space was peanut butter.
You guys have excellent guesses, but that's not the answer. Ah. Oh. Goodness gracious. But thanks for trying. I got an email notification this morning from one of the bee journals, and it was almost tongue-in-cheek. The headline says, you know, sign me up. Where do we get some? And apparently Korea is offering...
I saw this too. Yeah.
Maybe you have a better recollection of it, but there's a honey that's mixed with ginseng, maybe, and some other herbs.
No one's quite sure what it's mixed with, but they were saying it's going to... cure you from radiation sickness.
Yeah, protect you. Yeah, where do we get some there? Okay, now next bee that we'll talk about, and once again, this is Matthew Shepard with the Xerces Society here on the Dirtbag, is the mason bees. Typically, they would be in full force
this time of year. But I think we just had such a miserable March that the bees didn't bother coming out just yet.
And the mason bee, describe a little bit about it. It is a native bee.
It is the mason bee. Some people refer to it as the orchard mason bee. Some people call it the blue orchard bee. It's the same bee. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic pollinator of orchard crops, so apples, pears, cherries. Actually, less pears. Pears are an awkward one to get pollinated.
Yeah.
But the Asian pear, the mason bees like.
Could we come back to that? And we'll come back to the pear pollination. But
yeah,
go ahead.
Sure. Okay, so. No, and I was just going to say that the one thing about the mason bee, it gives most people who work with it the idea that bees are solitary and don't all live in a hive and don't all make honey. So the bumblebees are kind of social, but you only have a few dozen or a couple of hundred in the nest at maximum. And most of our native bees are social, so one female bee will make her own nest. And she only lives for a few weeks. And it happens that the mason bee that we love for orchards comes out early in the spring and so is out and about whilst the apple trees are flowering. And she'll only be out for a month or 5 weeks. And then she'll die, but she'll have made her nest, and then the bees stay in the nest for the rest of the year. And then they emerge the following spring when the weather's warm enough. It seems to be temperature that triggers their emergence.
Or doesn't,
yeah, which is maybe good for them.
Yeah. In this particular case, I've seen them end of February sometimes, but not this year.
No.
Now, I think you touched on the answer to this, our garden stumper this year, I mean this month, and we do have a caller with the... Kristen, what's the answer to the first food eaten in space by an American astronaut?
The perfect American apple.
Well, in most respects, that would be correct. They actually ate applesauce.
Oh.
Applesauce that came in an aluminum tube. That's what the Mercury astronauts ate in about 1962 or something like that. So thank you.
Thank you. Have you talked about wasps as pollinators?
We did mention that a little bit earlier about with the figs, but...
I missed that part.
We can... and they don't do it around here, the varieties that we grow here. We don't need those wasp pollinators.
Did ants have something to do with it?
For figs?
Uh-huh.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say the fig wasp is a very particular type of wasp. The female actually lives inside the fig flower. And the fig wasp itself is a tiny little thing, like maybe an eighth of an inch long.
Right.
And so it's not what we think about when we think of wasps, in the same way that most bees are not what we think about.
Right. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bye.
So all of the figs that we grow here don't need pollination.
Which is just as well.
Yeah, we don't need to deal with that.
Okay. Needs pollination, but just not a pollinator.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay, so mason bees then would generally be, they're a native bee, mm-hmm. but they also visit many of our non-native plants, particularly fruit trees.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of backyard orchardists mm-hmm. grow them.
Yeah.
Or raise them.
I mean, they're perfectly suited to the small-scale grower.
What other types of, let's see, we got carpenter bees. Let's just mention some of these here.
Sure. Yeah, but carpenter bees, where we are in Portland area, we don't get carpenter bees. They only come up about to Eugene area. Oh. Corvallis maybe is about as far north as they get. So, you know, if you're in southern Oregon, you may just have the large carpenter bees trying to chew into your wood. But where we are, we don't. But it's one of the things that we get most years is we get telephone calls in spring from people who actually have mason bees.
Uh-huh.
And they think that they have carpenter bees chewing at their house.
One indication of mason bees is that their holes are mudded over.
Yeah.
Hence their name, right. The mason.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, sweat bees.
We have sweat bees. They're gorgeous, bright metallic green.
And why are they called sweat bees?
Well, the story is that some of them will try and drink sweat from people. And so on the whole, you don't notice these bees until they're crawling on you. And then you swat at them, and then they get grumpy.
And they have stingers.
They do. All bees have stingers.
Well,
female bees have stingers, but most of them are highly reluctant. So mason bees, you can have handfuls of mason bees, and they'll just crawl around and then fly away.
Uh-huh.
And some bees are actually, their stingers too weak to penetrate human skin. So.
I see. Right. And then leafcutter bees.
Yep. Leafcutter bees are really cool. They make their nests, they line them with carefully cut pieces of leaf. And so sometimes rose growers don't like them because they tend to take leaves that are slightly rough on one side and shiny on the other.
And are those nests in the ground?
They will nest in naturally in old snags with beetle tunnels, but if you make mason bee blocks,
I see.
Then you'll get leafcutter bees in those.
And some of the ground nesting bees,
sweat bees are ground nesting.
Okay.
Mining bees are ground nesting. So there's a load of different bees out there.
I see.
Buy our book, learn all about it.
Right. Yeah. So we're talking just about the. Recently here, we've been talking about bees, but there are other pollinators, flies, beetles, that fly or don't fly.
Yeah.
Sometimes ants mm-hmm. can, not many.
Ants may.
Yeah, but they're up there getting nectar in any event.
Yeah.
But
probably wild ginger, maybe, or maybe trillium might be ant-pollinated around.
Oh,
there.
How about that? Yeah. That's a good thing to know. Okay, well, we've run out of time. We did get the stumper answered. And Matthew, it's been a pleasure to have you here and a wealth of knowledge.
Thank you so much.
Matthew Shepard with the Xerces Society. That's xerces.org.
And you'll find a wealth of information there, and you'll be able to buy seed from us too.
Yeah, that's great. And at the end of the year, you can get a bee calendar, or at least you have been able to the last couple of years, and the brand new book, Attracting Native Pollinators.
Great.
Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much.
Kurt, thanks a lot. This is Glenn Andreessen. We'll be back next month for the pledge drive. Be sure to tune in for that. We'll have some thank you gifts from that are edible plants. And be well.